What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And filling in for Adam Kempinar, I'm Michael Phillips. What do you mean, big?
Well, let's just say this Twinkie represents the normal amount of psychokinetic energy in the Chicago area.
According to this morning's sample, it would be a Twinkie 35 feet long, weighing approximately 600 pounds.
That's a big Twinkie.
A big Twinkie and a big loss for comedy. That was Harold Ramis as Dr. Egon Spengler in 1984's Ghostbusters. Ramis, the co-writer of that film, along with a number of other comedy classics, died last week at 69.
The Chicago-born Ramis was also the co-writer and director of 1993's Groundhog Day, which we revisit this week with a Film Spotting Sacred Cow review, plus our top five Harold Ramis moments.
All my data points to something big on the horizon.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM314.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh Larson here with Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Animal House, National Lampoon's Vacation, Caddyshack, Stripes, Ghostbusters, Analyze This. As an actor, a writer, and a director, Harold Ramis left an indelible mark on the last three decades of movie comedies. We remember the passing of the Chicago native this week with our top five Ramis moments. That's later in the show.
But first, Josh, I've been in the newspaper business some 30 years and have thankfully never had to cover a Groundhog Day celebration myself. In Harold Ramis' defining comedy, Bill Murray isn't quite so lucky.
Did you sleep well, Mr. Connors?
Did I sleep well?
Would you like some coffee?
Yes, please. I think I'll have a double.
I hope you enjoy the festivities. There's talk of a blizzard.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Will you be checking out today, Mr. Connors?
I'd say the chance of departure is 80%. 75-80.
That is Bill Murray in Harold Ramis' Groundhog Day from 1993. I think on the second day, the second Groundhog Day he experienced in that film, the second of many. And we are taking this opportunity to revisit Groundhog Day and thinking about where it stands among Ramis' work. It's probably the one that first came to mind for me. And the second one was Ghostbusters. And a lot of people felt the same way, certainly felt strongly for Ghostbusters. So we thought we would force Film Spotting listeners to make a tough choice. Rather than just appreciating these two films as they should be appreciated, Michael, we like to force people to choose them into a ridiculous choice.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we did put that to the listeners, and we'll let you share the results here, Michael, when it came to facing off Ghostbusters versus Groundhog Day. How'd it come out?
Well, Ghostbusters got 38% of the vote of the Ramis film that meant the most to them. Groundhog Day, almost double that at 62%. And I got to say, I agree.
Clear winner there. Brett from Newton, Massachusetts gave his reasoning. Ghostbusters is still brilliantly funny, but Groundhog Day is sublime. And I got to say, my recent reviewings of these films, I probably saw them within a day or two in the last week, and it did validate these results. I mean, Ghostbusters is still a ton of fun, but it didn't hold up as much as I would have hoped.
I'd say it's a half ton of fun.
A half ton of fun. There you go. I think maybe it was more suited to me at 11 or 12 than it is now. It was just the perfect film for that mindset. And that is about the time that I first saw it, probably more when it was out on VHS and I was watching it weekly somewhere. That's my memory a lot of these Ramis films, actually, is watching them on VHS at neighbors' houses or something like that. So Ghostbusters, still a good time, but really not working at the same level as Groundhog Day. And it sounds like you'd agree.
Right. And different ambitions for sure, Josh. I mean, Ghostbusters is basically an update on a lot of old ghost or, quote, scare pictures, scare comedies from the old days of Bob Hope used to do, where you just have much better for the 80s anyway, much better looking special effects ghosts and things. And I don't know if that movie really would be much at all if it didn't have Bill Murray basically heckling his own movie.
Uh-huh. I mean, there's a lot of that.
And that is. He's the reason that, but at the same time, it's also kind of a good chance to see, re-seeing it, lets you realize that having Ramis in there with Murray and Dan Aykroyd, that was the perfect amount of movie for Harold Ramis as a comic actor to be responsible for. Because he's a utility guy. He's a supporting guy. He's never been the spark plug that either of those guys are in different ways. And it's just fun to see him. But that's also the reason Stripes is such a gas, minor as it is. But I like Stripes. Personally, I like Stripes better than Ghostbusters.
I found that, too, because I revisited that in those same couple of days. I found that, too. Well, all of those probably deserving of a Sacred Cow review, which we like to do here on Film Spotting from time to time, taking a look at a movie that has an unblemished reputation, really, and seeing if it still holds up, if it still deserves that. But for this show, for this Ramis-focused show, we did choose to go with Groundhog Day. And we have a note here from a listener, Andy from Philadelphia, explaining his attachment to the film.
He says, "Hey guys, while I am sad it took Harold Ramis's passing for you to do a Sacred Groundhog on Cow Day, I'm happy you're giving it the treatment because it's my favorite romantic comedy of all time. It offers a good mix of high-concept humor, harsh reality, and hope around the subject of love, a subject that we all know Hollywood gets wrong most of the time. I love watching how Phil, the Bill Murray character, grows over the course of the film and at first spends time taking advantage of the situation to manipulate and woo the object of his desire into loving him. Yet no matter how much info he knows, she's smart enough to see it's never truly coming from his heart. As he realizes this will never work, he must go through the long, hard road of change and even grief to ultimately realize the best way to find love is through getting a real heart of his own by loving and being good to himself. It's the most inspiring and feel-good romantic comedy there is, the kind where you undoubtedly want them to get together in the end."
So there Andy talks about it connecting with him as a romantic comedy, and I think it's very much that, but it's also a movie that is doing a lot of other different things. I'm curious, Michael, I know that you have great appreciation for this film, so that's not really the question in this Sacred Cow review. We both do enjoy it quite a bit, but maybe we can start here by talking about its different parts and trying to define what it might be most. Do you think it works best as romantic comedy? Is it more likely to be seen as this spiritual, philosophical treatise? Or is this just another Bill Murray vehicle that's working in a little bit of a different way? And of course, there's the possibility that, to use Brett's word, it's a sublime combination of all of these things.
Yeah, I think Brett's right. Ramis used to talk in interviews about how everybody would come up to him practically every day of his life if he was out in public and say, "Groundhog Day, look, as a Jew, Groundhog Day speaks to me because it's very much, you know, in the Jewish, you know, it's asking questions that I confront in the Torah, blah, blah, blah." You know, puts his coffee down, picks it up, and suddenly Ramis is being bugged by some practicing Catholic who says this is very much, you know, these are religious questions.
Sure.
Especially about life and, you know, living a life of purpose that we deal. And it's that kind of flexible creation that really kind of almost in a great way gets away from its own creators and becomes its own thing. The movie, I think at the time, my memory's a little fuzzy on this, but in 93, certainly people weren't expecting a movie that's being sold on the face of Bill Murray to have really even a hint of kind of thematic ambition or sort of bittersweetness.
Probably not.
I mean, that's, he hadn't done only one kind of film up till then, but, you know, it's a different guy. It's a very different set of requirements of any comic actor than you get in, you know, the early stuff Murray did, Meatballs, Stripes, things like that. But there's something, I think it's worth talking about, Josh, how this project, Groundhog Day, came together in that Danny Rubin's original screenplay that Ramis then worked with him on and then wrote a little bit, co-wrote himself, started out a much more kind of blatantly philosophical and bittersweet piece from what I read. And that was certainly something that Murray wanted to explore. He was interested in that. He wasn't just, didn't want to do kind of the most obvious and the most kind of broadly comic treatment of this idea of a guy having to relive the same day over and over and over until he basically gets it right.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ramis came in and said, well, you know, I'd like to help sell these ideas with a certain amount of, you know, kind of a lighter touch or a commercial comedy. And usually, you know, when you hear of somebody coming in to, quote, you know, punch it up or rewrite, you think that's comedy death or
right.
else quality death. But Ramis had the kind of taste and just the comic chops and the sense to kind of not screw it up, essentially. And one of the real sad things about kind of revisiting the making of that picture, reading about it after Ramis's death recently, was how it was a contentious shoot, and Murray and Ramis, who had worked together plenty by then, you know, really weren't seeing eye to eye on how, quote, serious and how, quote, funny we're going to get this thing in the end. The miracle, I guess, is that they did get it right. And it sort of is a very easy traverse between some really kind of good, quick, punchy comic payoffs in terms of like Ned Ryerson, my favorite insurance man in the history of movies, played by Stephen Tobolowsky, and then much more serious scenes, which we'll get to in a sec. But Murray, at this point in his life and in his career, by Groundhog Day, he's an actor enough to know exactly how to play each scene. And Ramis is, by this point in his career, is just enough of a good director to kind of realize how to set the tone of the material so that it can be a little bit, it can be kind of something for everything without being cheesy or middlebrow.
What about me, Phil? Do you know me too?
I know all about you. You like producing, but you hope for more than Channel 9 Pittsburgh.
Well, everyone knows that.
You like boats, but not the ocean. You go to a lake in the summer with your family up in the mountains. There's a long wooden dock and a boathouse with boards missing from the roof. And a place you used to crawl underneath to be alone. You're a sucker for French poetry and rhinestones. You're very generous. You're kind to strangers and children. And when you stand in the snow, you look like an angel.
How are you doing this?
I told you, I wake up every day right here, right in Punxsutawney. And it's always February 2nd. And there's nothing I can do about it.
I do think it marks a transition point in Murray's career, for sure. And we'll probably get to that in a minute. But it also seems right to credit Ramis's touch with bringing that alchemy together, that concoction you're talking about, which in description alone, plot description, sounds awful. But when you think about Ramis devoting his life to a Zen Buddhism at this point, there's this sort of approach to the spiritual matters that is not heavy-handed. It doesn't push you into it as a viewer. And I think that's the masterstroke of the film, is how it gently guides us through these larger implications that are underlying the basic comic scenario. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're exactly right about different people from different religious persuasions being able to connect to it, because it does get at these deeper truths that everyone has wrestled with, but it does it in a very lightly comic way. It has time for those bits you're talking about with the insurance salesman, and really begins, the first maybe 15 minutes are a gentle comedy of media manners, how this is a small town news outlet. They have to cover this every day, and they go to this town, and the town is acting like it's the most important thing ever. But really, a lot of the people there are just there out of obligation. They do this every year. And we're starting to sense how this foreshadows not only what's going to come ahead for Murray's character, this time warp, but also how all of our lives can get stuck in these similar ruts. I mean, it's laying the ground for some of these very, very deep questions, I think. But to get back to Murray, because it was a prickly relationship from what you read, and sort of ended that way and lasted for a couple of years, I still think, as contentious as that collaboration might have been, this isn't the first time that Murray has tried to expand his talent in different directions. But I think it's one of those times where you see the Murray we know now beginning to really form. And I pinpoint it to the third time he awakens, I think, to Sonny and Cher's I Got You, Babe, another masterful touch to choose that song. And the look on his face, we begin to see sort of that comic melancholy, the dread almost that so many of his characters now have. The lines in his face begin to erase that sort of comic jester's prankiness and snarkiness. It starts to drain there. And there's a real richness to the whole rest of the performance in this film where he's able to give it that other layer that is so great about so many of his performances now.
Yeah, and he could have, if he had done this film 5 or 6 years earlier in his career, I think Murray may not have had the instincts, especially if he was working with a different director who was basically just saying, "Hey, you're killing it. Keep going." Yeah, you could see those early scenes where Phil Connors, the Pittsburgh TV weatherman, is just going to realizing, "Okay, I'm trapped. What do I do now?" If you don't, that could have been played much more broadly and probably gotten, yes, more audible laughs in the first half hour. But you know, Ramis, I think, I think he just knew that that wasn't the key to getting this film right. It's played much more subtly and realistically, and the magic is when you have a guy like Bill Murray playing subtly and realistically, it's still funny.
Exactly, because,
you know, you still get the jokes, and you know he's not. I like the scale of this movie so much. You know, Phil Connors isn't some sort of national TV celebrity who's. It's not a bunch of kind of like celebrity jokes. He's just kind of a medium market malcontent who is just he's a narcissist and he's certainly a bit of a blowhard, egomaniac. But
he has just enough stature to justify how he treats people. For the context of the film.
Right. But it's not blown up beyond that. I mean, that belongs to a different kind of comedy. And the fantasy element is on a very different scale than something like Ramis would have gotten into when he remade Bedazzled many years later with Brendan Fraser and Elizabeth Hurley, which operates on, you know, a kind of patently sketch comic scenario where you're dealing with different scenarios over and over and kind of trying to learn lessons or get the rug pulled out from you in one way or the other comically. And that, to me, the scale of that film is almost the downside when you add a little bit more money to a budget and what that does to comedy. I think the feeling of Groundhog Day is just perfect for what they're trying to accomplish. And also the lack of topical references in that script, people have remarked on this. It's not a film now that has a lot of references that immediately date. And that's why that film feels better and better every year.
And why Groundhog Day itself as a holiday is maybe perfect. It feels like we'll always have that with us. We'll never be able to escape
for whatever
that.
Reason.
Exactly. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. And we are revisiting Groundhog Day in light of Harold Ramis's passing, his legacy film, I would say it is. And Michael, you mentioned something about the darkness, hinted at the darkness in this picture earlier. And I think this is another example of something that Ramis and his co-screenwriter and the cast, they navigate very well, because there is a point where Phil Connors becomes so distraught that he contemplates suicide. And this is played for laughs. It's a suicide laugh montage, yet somehow there's a disturbing element of it, just enough that it is in sync, again, with these larger, deeper questions that the movie is asking. And it made me think of, it's not exactly the same tone, but we're thinking about Wes Anderson films because The Grand Budapest Hotel is coming out and we'll be looking at that next week. But it did strike me as similar to the way he'll frequently feature suicide in his pictures, sometimes right at the forefront, but sometimes as an aside. I think of The Darjeeling Limited, where it's just mentioned in a line of dialogue as an aside that we realize what happened. And it's that same sense here where if we're even going to deal with the prospect of suicide for someone who is this spiritually distraught in Groundhog Day, the only way we can maybe get our minds around it is to laugh about it a little bit. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to be laughing it away.
Right. And we'll get to this when we talk about our top five Ramis moments on film. But I'll mention now that I think the scene that really caps it in Groundhog Day is where he has been dealing over and over with the same characters in the small town, you know, day after day after day, and just sort of interacting with them in new ways because of the plight he's trapped in. And one of them is this apparent sort of old rummy, a homeless guy who's looking for handouts on the street corner. And at one point, he dies, and Phil realizes that he's taken him to the hospital, and the guy dies, and he can't do anything to save it. And that's kind of when he realizes that he doesn't have complete godlike control over his bizarre situation.
Are you the one who brought the old man in?
Mm-hmm. How's he?
Well, he just passed away.
What did he die of?
He was just old. It was just his time.
I want to see his chart. Excuse me.
Sir? Sir, you can't come in here. Sir, this is a restricted area.
Where's the chart?
Sometimes people just die.
Not today.
Those scenes are the ones that just knocked me out. First time I've seen it in years was just the other day. And that's, again, Murray, Ramis hitting precisely the right tone, just hard enough to make those scenes kind of matter and actually believe that they would lead to a guy's sort of eventual change of heart about just how he's living his life and treating people.
Because how wrong could those scenes go? I mean, the homeless man as this figure of sympathy.
Sounds mawkish as hell,
exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And somehow they do, again, manage to hit that balance. And speaking of sentimentality and going back to our listener, Andy from Philadelphia, who says he appreciates this so much as a romantic comedy, it could also feel mawkish as a romantic comedy. And I think it does work in that vein quite well also. But this may be a good opportunity to ask you, because I know on the show before you've made just a side comments about Andie MacDowell. may not be your favorite actress.
Well,
let's say that.
These will be front and center
okay.
comments.
Do you think she works here?
I think it took someone who I suspect was as unpredictable from take to take as Murray to kind of keep MacDowell completely disarmed and on her toes. And I think some of the flouncy affectation that gets in the way of her line readings in almost everything she does is kind of cut away here, because she just has to be a little more alert, I think, working with Murray. And yeah, the peculiarity, Josh, is that if you look at the genuinely good romantic comedies in English made in the last 25 years, how Andie MacDowell ended up as the co-star in two of them is sort of a mystery to me, because I'm a big fan of Four Weddings and a Funeral too, and you know she's got some moments in that just make you think, I can't believe this performer's actually done 25 movies already, because that just simply isn't the way to read that line. But there's much less of that in Groundhog Day. I think there's a simplicity. I think everybody, when Ramis passed the other day, MacDowell was interviewed by someone, and she said lovely things about echoing what everybody is saying. It's just that this was a warm, Ramis was such a warm presence, an easygoing, kind of mentoring, supportive guy. He just found a way to get people relaxed and into the groove. And you know, was he an amazing visual stylist as a comedian? Did he even know where to put the camera half the time in the early days? He used to laugh himself about how rudimentary the technique is in Caddyshack, the first film he got behind the camera on. I mean, that film barely functions as a movie, but you know, it had all the right people in it. So, but Ramis had it, and I love it, frankly, when somebody goes, and what you hear over and over is that to Ramis, it really was just important to be a nice guy in an industry where nice doesn't usually count.
Yeah, I think humility is the right word. The movie itself has that sense to it, and perhaps that's the defining characteristic that allows it to avoid some of the sentimentality, because it's not forcing that on you. It's very humble. It's just presenting the story that it has, and it's going where it's genuinely interested in going with it. It's not looking to necessarily convince you of where it's going with it. It's just right, Setting it out there, offering it to you. And there aren't many comedies that work that way in such a non-insistent manner, yet still do manage to be funny.
Yeah, exactly. Ramis also said in an interview, and I'm sure he said it many times in different interviews, people come back to Groundhog Day and they see it and they remember it fondly, typically. Maybe they see it 10 years later. And what he said to one interviewer was that they see it to see where they are in life and then to consider their own habitual behaviors. Maybe it's as simple as that. That doesn't put a religious name on it or even a spiritual name on it. It's just more about examining. It's a great comic question. What would you do in this situation? And it's treated in a way that makes this movie more interesting than, say, Bruce Almighty, the Jim Carrey thing, where it's another kind of like, what am I going to do with my powers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I really, this film holds up beautifully. And there's got to be a reason, Josh, why Stephen Sondheim wanted to make a musical out of it, and why it's so many different people's one of their very favorite movies, you know, from David O. Russell of American Hustle on over to Edgar Wright of Shaun of the Dead. These guys are not, they're all over the place in terms of style, but they all kind of go back to this film as a touchstone.
Groundhog Day is available at all Punxsutawney area bed and breakfasts and elsewhere. We want to hear what you thought of this film, either the first time you saw it or if you revisited it since. Please do send your email to feedback@filmspotting.net. We do always love it when you leave us voicemails as well, and you can do that at 312-264-0744. Of course, we are on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
And once and for all, we're going to close the door on 2013 with some observations about last weekend's Oscars and then ask listeners to name their favorite Wes Anderson movie, Jaguar Sharks versus Fantastic Foxes. The film spotting poll is next. Stay with us.
Quick interruption here, folks, to remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Doesn't matter if this is a website, an advertisement, a multimedia presentation, or some other film project, Shutterstock has over a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. They have clips in a variety of digital formats, and most do come in high definition. I did take a search on Shutterstock to get a feel for what might be available, and thinking about Ramis's films and touching on Ghostbusters, I thought I'd check for ghosts. And indeed, there were 63,000 results. Some were cute for the kids, those sorts of ghosties. Others were more in the vein of the recent horror film The Conjuring, if that's what you're looking for. I'm sure if I looked long enough, I'd even find something similar to Slimer from Ghostbusters. Shutterstock does source their video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Each video is reviewed individually for content and quality before adding it to Shutterstock's library, and they do add about 12,000 video clips each week. That way, every time you visit, you're going to find something new.
Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring your creative projects to the next level. It has sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. As you find the video assets you're looking for, you can save them to a clip box. Then you can access your selections anytime and share them with other team members. Shutterstock also has flexible pricing. Choose between individual clips or video packs, download clips in HD, or you can save with standard definition or web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start your account, begin using Shutterstock, and be sure to save your video selections that you do find to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM314, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM314. We thank Shutterstock for their support. Dropping dimes, laying sweet feeds on my homies.
No one can slow me down, but I'm gonna make you mine.
Thank you to the Academy for this incredible recognition. It doesn't escape me for one moment that so much joy in my life is thanks to so much pain in someone else's. And so I want to salute the spirit of Patsy for her guidance. And for Solomon, thank you for telling her story and your own. Steve McQueen, you charge everything you fashion with a breath of your own spirit. Thank you so much for putting me in this position. It has been the joy of my life.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. That was from last weekend's Oscar ceremony. You heard Lupita Nyong'o accepting her award for Best Supporting Actress for her performance as Patsy in Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave, which also won Best Picture. Michael Nyong'o managed to match her universally praised performance with a pretty equally praised acceptance speech. One of the few maybe that didn't receive any jeers in the Twitterverse or elsewhere. Would you say her win was a highlight for you from the evening?
I liked the speech. It was, I mean, the Oscars have become so weird, Josh. I mean, they sort of exist now just to be kind of raw material for all the wiseacres having a ball on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all when Ellen DeGeneres, the host, pulled out the camera and took the selfie, the almost crashed Twitter or whatever, and, you know, with a bunch of famous people.
Is that kind of admitting it, giving it over to Twitter?
I think so. Yeah. I do. I think it's there's something sort of odd about it. And to me, when you work in the show and you have to write crazy deadlines, writing an early edition version of an Oscar story at 9:30 before anything had been given out, yeah. And then a later one later, but you're only watching the show with sort of a half a human being's eye. You're just kind of watching the clock as a writer. But it seemed like that material was a little off for DeGeneres. Hmm. And you could do things like the pizza delivery gag, and I don't know.
Seem to go on a little while. It's interesting. I think you're onto something there in that it's become a minor aspect, the necessary aspect of the Oscar experience, because we need that to have everything else. But it's almost an afterthought. And I didn't do this intentionally. It's just how things fell out this year, because I've been online on Twitter during the Oscars before and had fun doing that as well. But I actually had this caveman experience, I guess. We just happened to have family members at our house. And so it was just analog for me. I didn't have out the phone and ended up doing something very odd, talking to the people next to me more often. And again, next year I'll probably be on Twitter, so I'm not putting that down or anything. But it was a very old school kind of nice experience where we were just taking in the show as the show itself.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when Ellen was doing the Twitter thing, you do realize how that's broken in now to the actual broadcast.
Yeah,
so.
And it's beyond just being a topical joke, because I still remember when Billy Crystal was, I think, doing his first Oscar host gig back when, and he did the boop boop, you know, the car locking your car from the stage off stage, and that was just when that kind of car was on the market. Now it seems like, you know, centuries ago.
Sure.
That actually predates film itself or something. But I don't know. It's just become sort of an odd thing where they're I think we can take this notion of let's have everybody join in on the conversation too far. It's just, I think they're almost kind of forgetting that the first order of business when you're even, I know the ratings were great, best ratings in 10 years, but in the first order of business, when you're going to do a show that lasts maybe 3 hours and 20, 25 minutes like last week's, you need to make sure the material is good and you have the right host with Ellen DeGeneres. She can deliver almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
But and also keep the burden kind of light. You know, she's not exhausting. She's not like an attack dog comedian or anything. But I don't know. Was I happy with the wins? Pretty much. I mean, I guessed right 19 for 24. So, you know,
not bad.
On that level, I was pleased. I certainly like, you know, the only thing I think is not going to look so great in a few years is McConaughey and Jared Leto for Dallas Buyers Club.
I got to say, I had that thought too. Let's run through just a couple of the winners here for those who didn't sit through all 3+ hours or maybe didn't really care at all and have yet to hear. But we did have Best Picture winner. I mentioned 12 Years a Slave, also won for Best Adapted Screenplay by John Ridley. The Director Award went to Alfonso Cuarón for Gravity. Cate Blanchett took Best Actress for Blue Jasmine. You mentioned McConaughey and Leto both winning for their parts in Dallas Buyers Club. We mentioned Nyong'o for 12 Years a Slave. The Best Original Screenplay Oscar went to Spike Jonze for Her. That one kind of surprised me a little bit.
Pleased.
You like that one, huh?
I love the film.
Yeah.
So,
well, that was your number one of the year, right? Last year. Well, there you go. Foreign language film, the winner there was The Great Beauty. Best animated film, Frozen. And best documentary feature, it was not The Act of Killing, which received the Golden Brick Award from us here at Film Spotting last year, but another movie I know Adam liked quite a bit, 20 Feet from Stardom. So looking at all of that, I think it shakes out well if you think about it in terms of history, to me at least. I'm certainly glad that 12 Years a Slave won over any of the other candidates. I liked quite a number of those films, but this is one not just because of its subject matter, but for how it's handled that I think is important to be recognized by the Academy. And I agree with you, especially when you look at the clips that were shown for the best actor categories. And I thought Matthew McConaughey was fine in Dallas Buyers Club, and you probably shouldn't judge all performances based on the clips chosen for that night.
Right.
But if you set them up against each other, that was a very thin McConaughey doing an interesting variation of McConaughey in his clip. And boy, those other guys were just working at completely different levels, I thought. And I'd even include Leonardo DiCaprio in that, in a film I didn't like that much, but he had some great moments, and we saw one there in that clip.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, DiCaprio's giving a really resourceful Jack Nicholson-tinged performance in Wolf of Wall Street just to see if he can keep that thing going for 3 hours. And I, you know, who knows? I may give Wolf of Wall Street another look in a year or two just to see.
I think you were on that one.
Yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I guess having American Hustle, a film I liked a great deal, end up with nothing. It does send a kind of an odd statement to the moviegoers of the future that this was just not in the ballgame at all. Where I think it's actually an interestingly divisive movie in that the people who like it really enjoy it and really just sort of find its peculiar mixture of comedy and a little bit of a docudrama kind of stimulating and just the acting kind of a gas. And other people just never got on board with it. They couldn't access the story. They couldn't really even figure out the particulars about Abscam it's trying to deal with. Or they never really started laughing. And that's it's one of those comedies that so does not tip its hand about what's supposed to be funny besides the hair in, mm-hmm. in everybody's hair. That it, sometimes it's just – I think that's a film if you dropped in at a multiplex screening of American Hustle in one city at 2:40 in the afternoon, you'd hear nobody laughing. And then you might go, you know, one city over at, you know, 4:40 and you might get sort of a, like a lot of laughter. So it's just one of those films.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, too, about opening the Best Picture category to a potential 10. I think there were 9 this year.
Right.
Does it really say something that a film like American Hustle, which I also liked quite a bit, goes away without any awards, or even something like The Wolf of Wall Street, which I did not like, but still went away without any awards, even though it was highly regarded in some circles? Is that a negative of having that many films brought to the party, in that it reflects badly on them to go home, when in reality it's not any sort of reflection of their quality, but that perception may exist? Whereas if you have 5, as they used to do, and cap it at that, you may have less of that feeling of really striking out at the Oscars.
Yeah, true enough. And you wouldn't get, if you had 5, would you have Dallas Buyers Club or Philomena in there in the Best Picture category?
Probably not.
But yeah, I still run into people. We've talked about this. 12 Years a Slave, they haven't seen it yet because they just feel like it's going to be excruciating. Not necessarily bad, you know, but just such a difficult sit that they will not go. I just encourage anybody who's out there, feels that way, to just take a chance and see that Steve McQueen, the director, is really taking care of that material so that it doesn't become strictly a punishing experience for the audience in the way that so many other directors might have let that same material become. And just a grind, like truly grinding down on this. And instead, it's not. It's a very lucid and, I don't want to say dispassionate film, because it's full of feeling, but it doesn't have that kind of manipulative obviousness that so many other directors would have brought to it.
It's purposely punishing. I mean, it's punishing in just the right amounts and how it should be to give us just some sense of the reality without making that the point of the film.
Yeah.
And so I agree with you there. And I did watch it again just the night before the Oscars and came away feeling even more strongly that this really should be the film that wins and has that sort of status. And hopefully that will push it over the end for those people, like you said, who feel like they know what they're going to get into and feel like they know the film already.
Yeah.
Because I really don't think they do until you've actually experienced it. Well, if you want to hear how well Adam and my Oscar predictions matched up with reality, you can check out last week's show. That's when we had special guest Kyle Buchanan from New York Magazine's Vulture on. I think Kyle batted about 1,000 in the major categories, and Adam and I fared only slightly worse, though. My strategy of going with counter picks in the acting categories, thinking the Academy might spread the wealth around, that did not work for me.
So what did you get overall out of 24?
I think I did not win among the family members. I was beaten out by my sister and someone else. I think I had 14. So
out of 24?
You also beat
me. I'm not even going to finish this book.
I'm sorry.
I can't even stay here.
Well, it's priorities. I perhaps did not research well enough for the Oscars.
I did love the fact you can bet on the Oscars legally in London. And the London odds makers leading up to the week were fairly accurate in their outcomes. Cate Blanchett was a 1-50 favorite.
Okay.
I mean, she would have had been hit by a plane so to not win.
You're saying I shouldn't put any money on my bets.
Don't bring your own opinions about...
I know that rule. I had a counter theory. That's what I was
for. This is the time for the other side of the brain, you know, the yeah. craven, horrible side. Yeah.
That's true. Well, in addition to my terrible Oscar predictions, Adam and I also gave the Sacred Cow treatment in our last show to Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles. That's going to be show number 479. You can find it on iTunes and at filmspotting.net.
Get in!
We found the butler. He's hiding out in the remote foothills near Gabelmeister's Peak. Our contact convinced him to meet you midday tomorrow at the observatory on the summit. Tell no one. He'll explain everything. Your train departs in 4.5 minutes. Here's your tickets.
Oh, third class.
It was overbooked, but the conductor used to be a sommelier at the old Versailles. He pulls some strings. You'll need these for the dining car.
That was Bill Murray, very appropriate for this Harold Ramis-themed show. Here, though, he's in a scene from Wes Anderson's eighth film, the soon-to-be-released The Grand Budapest Hotel. Next week on the show, Michael and I are going to review Grand Budapest, and we're also going to share our top five Wes Anderson scenes. Top five I can't wait to dig into myself, even though it will be very difficult. Your job at this point, though, is going to be telling us which is your favorite Wes Anderson film so far. We're not including Grand Budapest in this list, although I think it might be out at this time, perhaps in New York and L.A. We're just looking at his previous films. Michael, right. That list includes...
You want the favorites, and I want to hear why, right? You want reasons.
We always want to hear why.
The reasons. So, your favorite Wes Anderson film, is it Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, The Darjeeling Limited, Fantastic Mr. Fox, or Moonrise Kingdom, his most recent film, until The Grand Budapest Hotel?
We do have them there for you in chronological order. Is this an easy choice for you, Michael? Can you look at these titles and pinpoint right away your favorite?
If it's based on my first viewing of these, it is an easy choice. Because I when I saw Rushmore, I just completely thought, this guy's got a voice.
Uh-huh.
I'd seen Bottle Rocket and liked it. But Rushmore did seem to be, okay, this is he's really jumped up right away. And there's other films, Josh, that I really am so eager to see again before we talk next about Anderson, Royal Tenenbaums. And I love Hackman in that so much. There's scenes in that are just great. Fantastic Mr. Fox, that was a little cool on the first time. Liked it much better the second. Liked Moonrise Kingdom right away. But, these are all things that a second viewing a few years later after a little time and space can help you cement it. But for me, Rushmore, what about you?
Yeah, I would go there too. And that was my instinctive pick. And after multiple viewings, it still is at the top for me. You're absolutely right that Anderson is a filmmaker who requires second viewings of his pictures. And we should do that for every film, to be honest. But there are some that the reward is so much greater when you do see them a second time. So even having done that multiple times with his films, for me, it is still Rushmore. We do want to hear what listeners pick among these titles, however, and as Michael said, your reasons for the pick as well. You can do that by voting at filmspotting.net. Just a couple of notes here before we move on. We did receive an email from Tom Spielman, and it was titled Help a Film Club Out. That's sort of hard for us to resist when we get an email asking for a plea like that, knowing their fellow cineasts who are possibly writing that. This is the note from Tom.
As my email address implies, I'm a student at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and I'm currently one of the leaders of its Film Arts Committee. Founded by none other than Paul Schrader during his undergraduate days here, the Film Arts Committee seeks to expose the Calvin student body and greater Grand Rapids to a wide variety of films from all genres and all countries. Now, on Saturday, March 8th, we're going to be screening Jean-Luc Godard's classic French New Wave picture Band of Outsiders at the DeVos Communications Center. The screening is at 8 p.m., and like all film arts screening, it's free with an optional post-screening discussion. Those who speak French or are knowledgeable about this period in cinema history are especially invited, but all are welcome.
We're squeaking that one in a little bit under the wire there, Tom, but hopefully we will call attention to it for a few people who are in the Grand Rapids area. Glad to hear that you are giving a great film like Band of Outsiders a screening, and I won't be at that screening, but I am going to be at Calvin College coming up here. It's for their Festival of Faith and Writing, which takes place in April. It's from the 10th to the 12th. It's mostly a festival for writers, and writers come and speak. Writers go and talk about their craft. They'll be having Anne Lamott there, James McBride, and throwing in a little music as well. The National will be performing. They have a neat facet of the festival called these festival circles, where attendees can offer to lead small group discussions about certain topics, all tied to writing. And I'm going to be leading one on film criticism, actually, talking to critics who do that on the side, who do it professionally. We'll just get together and talk about the craft of that and how we do it, where it is right now, and would love to have some people join me there. If you're thinking of going to the Festival of Faith and Writing or might want to give it some consideration, we'll link to it in the show notes where you can go ahead and find my festival circle and sign up for that if you're interested. One more note real quick here has to do with bonus content. I haven't yet asked you this, Michael, but in addition to doing extra duty co-hosting here, I'm thinking I might be able to twist your arm and get you to hang around and talk about Blazing Saddles for
right.
a few minutes.
In the Pantheon? Really?
Well, it's not a Pantheon film, but we did do a Sacred Cow review of it, we want to weigh our opinions against yours and at least see where things stand.
My opinions are actually sold by volume, not by weight.
No.
So, just so you know.
That could be a problem. Well, if you do want to check out that bonus content, go over to filmspotting.net and you can get information about the Film Spotting app. That is the easiest place to get our bonus content. The app is available on iPhone or Android or Windows 8 phones. And we do like to share extra bonus audio that you can get only the app as often as we can. Again, just go to filmspotting.net and click on the apps link.
Before we get to Mel Brooks in bonus content, we'll consider the legacy of another comedy legend, the late Harold Ramis, with our favorite moments from his career. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Only a chariot could carry it across this void. I wouldn't jerry-rig or candy-coat your Latin kisses. You're not what you aren't. But you're not. You got what you want. You want what you got. People look great when they shave, don't they? We lived on Tennyson and venison and the Grateful Dead. Was mud, honey, summer, torture, mystics, double bummer.
Donation time here on Film Spotting, where we take a few moments just to say thank you to those who do enable us to keep doing what we're doing. A note about our music first here. You've been listening to Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks. We've heard Lariat and Chart Junk. Those are both from the band's sixth album, Wig Out at Jagbags. Malkmus is formerly the lead singer and guitarist of Pavement. His band is currently on a U.S. tour that brings them to Houston and Dallas this weekend before they do head to the West Coast. More information is at StephenMalkmus.com. Getting to our donations here, Michael, we do want to thank a gold-level donor. That would be Sheila from Sherwood Park, Alberta, and Buckasho donor Jared from Astoria, New York.
Now, just to be clear, Josh, if you're a $10 a month gold donor level, we actually have to come to their home and review films.
I believe that's true. We might want to check with Adam on that. He knows all the technicalities.
Okay, I know he's paying for the travel, too. Jared from Astoria in New York says, Buckasho, been listening since, 2006 in the Cinecast days. Saw a movie with Adam in Boston, and before he left the show, got to have a drink with Maddie Ballgame here in Astoria. Josh, Sam Van Perbele, you guys are next to complete the collection.
Sounds great, Jared. I would love to do that sometime. We also want to thank $5 a month donor Alina C. She's from Parts Unknown, apparently. And regular donor Oliver from Auckland, New Zealand.
And Oliver says, love the podcast, even though I have to make a mental note of each episode and go back to listen months later when the films you review finally get released in New Zealand. For example, I'm planning to see Inside Llewyn Davis this weekend, only a week after it's been released.
Better late than never, Oliver, especially for Inside Llewyn Davis. Thank you so much. Thank you also to Alina, Jared, and Sheila, and everyone who does support the show. We really appreciate hearing from you and, of course, receiving those donations.
You're not what you aren't. You are what you're not. You got what you want. You want what you got. Feel so great in the shade. A love like oxygen, so foxy then, so terrific now.
Hey, this is Mark Duplass, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I have a vision for how my life would go, and this definitely is
Wait,
not.
Is this your it. Vision? Are you living your vision right
I
now?
I am kind of living my vision.
Wow, that is sad, I'm telling you. Life doesn't care about your vision, okay?
Stuff happens, you just gotta deal with it. You roll with it, that's the beauty of it all.
I just don't get how I tell the kid not to do drugs when I do drugs. I'll feel like a hypocrite.
Well, remember what I told you? When you were a teenager?
What did you say?
I said, no pills, no powders.
That's right.
If it grows in the ground, it's probably okay.
I mean, I guess it worked. Like, you told me not to smoke pot all those years, and then I found out you were smoking pot that whole time.
Not the whole time, just in the evenings and all day every weekend. Not that much.
That was the late Harold Ramis with Seth Rogen in Judd Apatow's Knocked Up. When news broke February 24 of Ramis's death, Apatow was one of the current comedy heavyweights who pointed to him as a key influence. He told Hollywood Reporter that he hired Ramis for Knocked Up, quote, because we all saw him as the dream dad, funny, warm, and wise. Harold was one of the nicest people I have ever met, and he inspired countless people to go into comedy. Looking back on his career, Michael, as we've both been doing this past week or so, how would you describe the influence he did have on the next generation of comedy filmmakers?
It was immense, and it wasn't just because he was a Chicago. You know, when somebody, when a major local figure dies, like Harold Ramis did recently here in Chicago, Chicago always has a way of inflating into insane proportions.
True.
The importance of so-and-so, or just in a provincial way. I think it's kind of just, it's in the bloodstream here, but Ramis, that influence really was immense, and so many people credit a lot of the films, and a lot of them aren't even really, God knows they're not formally polished or even particularly well-structured comedies, but they credit the films that he had hooked up with, co-writer of Animal House, co-writer of Meatballs, nobody's idea of a classic, the Bill Murray summer camp thing back from 79, but you go right through all those films, you know, films like Stripes and Ghostbusters, all that, and then on up to a film that is truly a damn good film in almost every way, Groundhog Day. That's an amazing amount of laughs, and it's all kind of this, especially the early work, it's this sort of gently transgressive sort of comedy that has been brought into the mainstream. And when you think of how enormously popular something like Animal House was, something like Caddyshack, which was Ramis's first time behind the camera, that's an amazing influence. And it all goes back even before that, of course, to his years at Second City, mm-hmm. on stage in Chicago and then up in Toronto, and that first season when he was the head writer and basically the showrunner of this amazing sketch comedy show, SCTV, which had just... that's the smackdown you can never solve. What was the greater cast for a certain kind of television comedy at around the same time? SCTV versus even the peak casts and the peak years of Saturday Night Live. That's a very good battle. But of course, Ramis worked with people from both camps, and so he's kind of the stealth figure, the stealth kind of linchpin of all this amazing, an entire generation's worth of great comedy.
And our challenge this week was to comb through all of that, or as much as we could, and try to compile lists of the top five moments, as you said, whether he was involved as a screenwriter or a director or an actor. So trying to do that and narrowing it down to five, what was at your number five slot, Michael?
I have 76.
Well, that could be first, possible.
Number five would be from that first season of SCTV that was made in Toronto, and this is with Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, all these amazing, amazing talents. Harold Ramis was the head writer and showrunner and sometime performer, kind of a supporting player beneath the kind of the level of John Candy and the rest of them. And it's great fun to see, and this is what YouTube's good for, right? It's great fun to see some of Ramis's sketches from that first season where in one he's always playing neurologists or eye doctors or something. It's almost like this is the doctor his parents wanted him to be.
He did in Groundhog Day,
yeah,
too.
Right, exactly. If he's a neurologist in Groundhog Day, it's like he just had to do it in terms of comedy. But he's always playing these sort of smiling authority figures that are trying to sell you something. In one SCTV bit, he plays he's shilling for something called the North American Stethoscopy Institute, where it's just how do you learn how to work a stethoscope and then parlay that into a career. So,
as a stethoscopist, I get to spend my day in clean, modern hospitals working right alongside respected doctors as a vital part of the medical team. And wow, does it pay. What with hospitals charging more and more every day for stethoscopological examinations. And where did I learn to handle a stethoscope? At the North American Stethoscopy Institute. And with their advanced courses, someday I may be a fully licensed stethoscopologist, or do stethoscopological research, or even learn electron stethoscophotographology.
Ramis never had great range as a comic performer. It's more just about finding a sweet spot and sticking with it. And he couldn't do the impressions and the full immersion embodiment of something like when Dave Thomas did Bob Hope. You just kind of like were astonished at how great it was. And Ramis wasn't like that. But with characters like just where he just comes on and says, "Hi, I'm Ned Gorman." The one character he played called the world's grumpiest kid show host, Muley, who's like a station master and who's always muttering about Bolsheviks and, you know, worried about getting fired and, you know, complaining about what's in his lunch today and talking to the kids a little bit. And it's worth seeing. I'm going to lump all my number five into his season on SCTV. Not a great comic actor, but you got to see where it all started.
Good. I'm glad we got something in there from his sketch career. I think that's entirely appropriate. My number five, I'll get to in just a minute, but first talk a second about the challenge that this list was, because Ramis, as you mentioned, he wasn't often at the center of things, at least from our perspective as viewers.
Right.
We've come to learn that he very much was at the center of creating so much great comedy, but he was often almost the straight man, really, especially early on when he would be paired with Bill Murray. And my number five is going to be one of his iconic straight man roles, Dr. Egon Spengler from Ghostbusters, the bookish straight-laced member of the ghostbusting team. There's a specific moment I'm thinking of from that film. But first, I want to read from your colleague, Mark Caro. He had the Chicago Tribune obit for Harold Ramis, and in it, he quoted a 1999 Trib interview in which Ramis talked about his comic presence. He evaluated himself here, saying, "The moment I knew I wouldn't be any huge comedy star was when I got on stage with John Belushi for the first time. When I saw how far he was willing to go to get a laugh or to make a point on stage, the language he would use, how physical he was, throwing himself literally off the stage, taking big falls, strangling other actors, I thought, I'm never going to be this big. How could I ever get enough attention on a stage with guys like this? I stopped being the zany. I let John be the zany. I learned that my thing was lobbing in great lines here and there, which would score big and keep me there on the stage." And I think so many of his earlier performances did employ exactly this technique. My Ghostbusters example comes from his reaction in the climax to seeing the giant Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man.
"Ray has gone bye-bye, Egon. What have you got left?"
"Sorry, Beckman. Terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought."
The way he delivers that hyperbolic line with such a flat reading, you know, that's what makes it really work.
He
doesn't oversell it at all. And it made me think, looking through a bunch of his films, is that Ramis was, he was the straight man who could also be funny. He wasn't just there to be the straight man. And in a way, becoming a director, which he eventually would, is sort of like becoming the ultimate straight man. But we'll get to that idea maybe a little bit more on my list. How about your number four, though, Michael?
I almost wish my number four were the moment in Ghostbusters where he just where Annie Potts, the secretary, asks him, "Do you have any hobbies?" And he says, "I collect spores, molds, and fungus."
Yes.
But it's the same kind of deadpan you're talking about. And I think the great thing about Ramis is he knew that if you have a character named Egon Spengler and you have hair that goes completely vertically and you're just surrounded by all this nonsense and activity and chaos, that's all you got to do is just sort of like just show up and talk.
Yep.
You know, that's it. My number four is actually something that I wish I knew what sort of hand he had in the writing of this, but Ramis was one of four writers on the film Meatballs, Ivan Reitman's big hit made in Canada with a lot of Canadians, and Bill Murray at the center, who was already a big star from Saturday Night Live, but not yet a movie star. It's a sloppy, barely coherent summer camp comedy that's rude one minute and sentimental the next, and Murray basically saves it. But there's one speech in it where he's trying to rouse the campers, the camp, to kind of like compete against all the privileged snobs across the lake.
"Bleed for a week to 10 days, even if God in heaven above comes down and points his hand at our side of the field, even if every man, woman, and child held hands together and prayed for us to win, it just wouldn't matter, because all the really good-looking girls would still go out with a guy from Mohawk because they got all the money. It just doesn't matter if we win or we lose. It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter."
There's something in that if, and I'm glad to be able to point out that Meatballs is historically important.
Yes.
For this reason. That's the first time we hear on film one of those classic speeches that I believe Ramis had a direct hand in writing. We never know with four people credited for a script, but there's similar speeches in Animal House, in Stripes, God knows, and it's that kind of great, sly, and then eventually completely subversive rah-rah speech that kind of throws the pie in the face of everything by the end. And it works like crazy with audiences because you're so used to hearing it, especially if you are seeing these movies back when, so used to hearing kind of the straight stuff that when you get this one with the kind of the kicker, it's delightful. But yeah, that is the historical importance of Meatball.
It's something of a monument in that way, huh? Well, the speech thing is exactly right. You can trace that throughout his career. And I was hoping to find something, and maybe someone else is aware of this, that could attribute Bill Murray's American speech in Stripes to Ramis, because it does have that familiarity from some of his other films. Couldn't quite find that, so I went with another moment from Stripes for my number four. And I do have to say, revisiting some of these, I realized, particularly with Stripes, a lot of these Ramis films were movies I saw when they had circulated onto VHS, and I would have been down the street at a neighbor's house where there were older brothers who had these things just on the loop.
What are you kids watching in there?
Pretty much. And probably not entirely appropriate, but that's where my mind went back to when I started rewatching these. I think it had been a good 20-some years since I'd seen these. So Stripes I picked because watching it here, you realize that despite that quote I read earlier, Ramis wasn't about to entirely leave the spotlight just yet. He did like to grab his moments, even if they were just a line. Here he plays Russell Ziske, who has impulsively joined, great names for his characters, right? He's impulsively joined the army with Bill Murray's John Winger. And he's certainly secondary to Murray, but he's still sort of a punk instigator in his own way. And the best example of this might be their interview with the army recruiter.
Now, there's a couple of questions that I have to ask you. They're a little personal. Have you ever been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor? That's robbery, rape, car theft, that sort of thing.
Convicted?
Yeah.
No.
Never convicted.
That's good. Good. Are either of you homosexuals?
You mean like flaming or?
Well, it's a standard question we have to ask.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Again, it's the delivery of it, because he's not necessarily establishing in a broad, loud way the establishment authority figure. He's playing with them, right?
Yeah,
part of it is, how is this guy going to react to what I have to say?
That's a great line reading, because so many other actors would have just said, no, but we're willing to learn, and end that way.
Yeah.
But somehow that sort of like weird zest he gives the line, like, we're willing to learn.
It
totally nails the joke. Yeah.
He pushes the interviewer just a little bit further by doing that. And a lot of Stripes works this way. It's a very genial, subversive, anti-authority comedy. You never really feel threatened by any of these guys.
Yeah,
do the authority figures necessarily have a need to feel threatened? But they're needling them underneath the entire time.
Yeah. It's the kind of army service comedy. Of course, the service comedy goes back to, you know, Chaplin doing Soldier Arms in 1918 or something. But every decent comedian, well, not everyone, but a lot of them did their army comedy, their service comedy over the years. But Stripes could only have happened comfortably distant from the Vietnam War and comfortably before all the other nonsense American got into a little later, because it's completely benign. There's no sense of any consequences.
No.
You know, there's at some point, I think they invade. I haven't seen this for a while.
Yeah, the last third is a completely ludicrous invasion
of Czechoslovakia, right? Yes. And there's a great line where he says, hey, we're just going to Czechoslovakia. It's like going to Wisconsin for the weekend. You know,
and that's how the movie treats it.
Yeah, right.
Well, extra points for that Stripe scenes, too, though, for the massive white afro Ramis sport. I mean, you talked about the hairdo in Ghostbusters. That has nothing on this.
Yeah, he's got some major hair. Yeah.
All right, you're number three, Michael.
It's one of two I have on my top five from Groundhog Day, because it is, you know, broken record. It's Ramis' best film as a director, and it's the film that's above all the others. And this is the serious scene that I think is the reason it works. The way Ramis co-wrote and then directed those scenes where Bill Murray's character, the TV weatherman from Pittsburgh, is sort of, you know, grinding through his day after day after day, and then when the story takes a brief detour into the life and then the death of this apparent homeless guy, this Rummy, who's a panhandler and who Murray's character does some interaction with reluctantly at first, and then realizes, well, you know, I think I'm going to try to save this guy. Takes him to the hospital, and he dies. And Murray just kind of refuses to accept that. That those scenes, we talked about it before, Josh, but those scenes are the key to why you believe that Murray's character is worth caring about. And that's where Ramis just suddenly leapt into a new kind of maturity as a director. He knew how to play those scenes, and the kind of the key to the why that film has an emotional core, aside from the love story, aside from all the things that are just truly funny about it, the film has its heart in the right place, and that's because of Ramis.
Yeah, and it's one thing for a comedy director to make a move into that sort of territory, go for a scene like that. It's an entirely different thing for a comedy director to be able to make it work that early in his career, because you can see where attempts have been made and it just falls flat, and certainly doesn't in Groundhog Day. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson alongside the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips, and we're reflecting back on the career of the late Harold Ramis by trying to narrow down 10 moments that try to encapsulate that great career. For my number three, I'm going to go to a film I wasn't able to revisit recently, but I know I've seen many, many times, especially in my youth. It's National Lampoon's Vacation, and it's Clark Griswold's Breakdown. I came across this scene on Screen Crush. They listed this in their tribute to Ramis, and I think it does stand out among his work. It's when Clark's Ahab-like pursuit of this Wally World vacation is called into question by the rest of his family. Heresy, you know, heresy to have your family call into question your vacation choice. But he's not about to relent.
Clark, under the circumstances, I wouldn't mind if we just went home. In retrospect, it seems like a pretty bad idea driving out. It's been one disaster after another.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad. Maybe we can try it some other time. Wally World's overrated anyway.
What do you think?
I think you're all f***ed in the head. We're 10 hours from the f***ing fun park and you want to bail out. Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun. I'm going to have fun, and you're going to have fun. We're all going to have so much fun we'll need plastic surgery to remove our goddamn smiles.
This is my first pick of Ramis's work as a director, and I think he does manage to make every element of this scene work. We have the kids, that whininess, which is just an additional irritant to Clark, just kind of gets him going a little bit further down the road to insanity. And Beverly D'Angelo, who's so good in this film as his wife, I love how she only stokes the fire by being sensible and reasonable. Those are the two things he doesn't want to hear at that point. And the setting from the scene, even as they drive through this downpour, Screen Crush rightly notes, I think, it lends a little bit of horror to the moment as well. And then, of course, you have Chase, who he's given the space by Ramis to do his deranged dad thing. And I think this is another example of how Ramis, when he settled into that director role, was able to do it with that straight man mentality a little bit, set things up for the stars to just really hit it out of the park.
Yeah, that's a film that didn't mean much to me when it came out. And I don't know if I was too young or too old or what, but seeing it again just the other day, it's a darker picture. Everybody always jokes about the incest gags and how, you know, that it's a little edgy in that regard. I wouldn't put it up anywhere near my favorites of his, but you can see why it was a success. You know, I think again, Ramis is sort of slipping some fairly twisted material right past the guard dogs and into a big hit, and you know, became a franchise, of course, and everything else. It's Chevy Chase to me is never going to be, and never has been, as interesting as Bill Murray.
No,
but to look at Chevy Chase in Vacation and then a couple years later in Fletch, that was the best he ever got in the movies, and it was amazing. He had a huge career, and then, you know, there's plenty of films, Josh, that we're not having part of this discussion for good reason, because all these people we're talking about, Bill Murray, Chase, Dan Aykroyd, they made plenty of films on the level of Spies Like Us. And, you know, films that just don't really roll around in the memory, even if you didn't mind them at the time. But there is a reason that something like Vacation and even Caddyshack really hang in there in people's memories. And it's not just because they're reliving their youth. It's because there's something about the quality of the laughs. And Ramis is part of the reason.
Yeah, I think The Darkness is a little bit why National Lampoon's Vacation does endure for me. And maybe it's an age thing, too, because you see it as a kid and you're laughing at different things because you're thinking about your own vacations with families as a kid. But then you see it as the dad, you know, and something else will strike you. And being able to embrace that moment, having a mainstream comedy like that, being able to really embrace that moment when everyone there is sick of each other and just wants to go home.
Yeah, right.
You know, I just I do really appreciate that. All right, we're up to our number two picks for Harold Ramis moments. Michael, what have you got in that slot?
Okay, this is one where I am reliving the movie I saw when I was 17, and I don't know how it's going to look to me in another 10 years, but when Animal House came out in 78, it really did seem like this is great. I'm seeing an adult comedy, and I can't wait to go to college, and look, it looks fun. You know,
it's exactly like this.
Even if I'm not in a fraternity, even the slobs, I'll have a good time. Ramis is one of three screenwriters on that picture. And again, you don't really know who created what bit necessarily in all cases, but we're back to that sort of classic pseudo-inspirational blather trope, the idea that we're going to have a character kind of like, you know, at a low point, kind of rally the troops. And it's that scene where Belushi, as Bluto was saying, you know, where were you when the Germans bombed Pearl Harbor?
This could be the greatest night of our lives, but you're going to let it be the worst.
Oh, we're afraid to go with you, Bluto. We might get in trouble. Well, just kiss my ass from now on. Not me. I'm not going to take this. Warner, he's a dead man. Marmalade, dead. Niedermeyer,
dead. Bluto's right. Psychotic, but absolutely right.
It's the kind of thing that Ramis, I think, if he had a hand in writing this, and I think he did, it links it back to the same kind of speeches you got in Meatballs,
mm-hmm.
Right around the same time. And it's not really that condescending or snarky or puerile a sense of humor. I mean, there's all that in all those films, and that's part of their appeal. And it's also kind of the part of their limitation, because it's an arrested development boy's life view of the mm-hmm. world and women and authority figures and all the establishment, all the rest of it. But Ramis somehow, just through sheer wit, transcends that. And I think that's when you see Animal House today, you think it's just a better, more interesting, and yeah, even generous-minded comedy, considering it deals with all those miserable stereotypes. And, you know, I don't think the African-American community is well-served. I don't think the women are necessarily well-served. But, you know, we have complicated reactions to these things. And you get older and you see the films you loved as a kid and you think, yeah, well, I was 17 or 15 or whatever you were. And yet the film really does work in some ways, different ways. Now it works, it still works. And again, I think it's, you're looking at Ramis in kind of a different role here, just as one of several screenwriters, but he was truly not destined to be a performer all his life. He was sort of an accidental performer and a good one, but he was a real writer, and then he got to be a real director.
You know, when you talk about the changing perspective we have and what communities weren't well served, I was taken aback actually by Stripes, how they handled the two female characters there, the military police that were played by PJ Souls and Sean Young, because they very much could have been, and maybe this is some sort of growth from Animal House, but they very much could have been just the sex object jokes, but they're fully incorporated, making independent decisions about how they are going to respond and react to the Ramis and Murray characters. They've got a lot of control in that film, and they're included in that last segment where they invade Czechoslovakia. I mean, they're very much actors in that scene as well. So that did surprise me that there was this little glimmer of enlightenment,
right,
maybe,
right.
In something like Stripes.
Right. The enlightenment, I think, is that they don't do nude scenes. Right.
Well,
I think
a little beyond that.
Yeah, but even some of the sexual material in Animal House is actually quite funny. And I mean, Ramis worked at the higher, and this is the old Second City motto from the Chicago stage here, you know, work at the top of your intelligence.
Yes.
Don't always go for the cheapest, grossest, whatever. And that was Animal House's reputation when it came out. Oh my God, it takes gross out humor to a new level. And mm. da, 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 da. see it today, and it's like Congreve. It's like witcherly, you know. I mean, compared to some of the stuff we have to kind of sit through today. And if you, I'm sorry, but you put Animal House up against something like one of the Hangover movies, and one seems like a comedy with human beings in it. The other just seems like horrible people you hope you don't have any kind of DNA connection with. So,
all right, my number two is going to go back to Groundhog Day, the film we did review for the show, and it's the diner confession scene. Now, at this point in Groundhog Day, Bill Murray's weatherman has been so driven to despair by being trapped in the same day over and over that he's even unsuccessfully tried to commit suicide. The next morning in the diner, he finally confesses. This is what he resorts to. After suicide comes honesty in his world. So he finally confesses to his colleague, played by Andie MacDowell, and tries to convince her of his predicament by predicting things that are going to happen in the scene since he's already lived it. He also shares some secrets about the fellow customers.
This is Doris. Her brother-in-law, Carl, owns this diner. She's worked here since she was 17. More than anything else in her life, she wants to see Paris before she dies.
Oh, boy, what a... What are you doing?
This is Debbie Kleiser and her fiancé, Fred.
Do I know you?
They're supposed to be getting married this afternoon, but Debbie is having second thoughts.
What?
Lovely ring.
This is Bill. He's been a waiter for 3 years since he left Penn State and had to get work. He likes the town, he paints toy soldiers, and he's gay.
I am.
This is Gus. He hates his life here. He wishes he stayed in the Navy.
Well, I could have retired on half pay after 20 years.
Excuse me, is this some kind of trick?
Well, maybe the real God uses tricks. You know, maybe he's not omnipotent. He's just been around so long. He knows everything.
There's not a lot of cutting in this scene, which I think is interesting. And it actually has some fairly sophisticated blocking. We've talked about Ramis's early use of the camera and how much he paid attention to that. But there's some camera movement here, some sophisticated blocking, especially for a comedy, as Murray makes his way from one customer to the other. It's an extended take. And there's some nice symmetry, too, because the sequence starts with this close-up on Murray's face, then travels all through the diner, and then settles back on him for another close-up. By this time, he and Andie MacDowell have, of course, moved to another table. So it's fairly elegant, and it's a key emotional moment as well. Because
it's his Ophuls moment. That's his Max Ophuls moment.
Yes, exactly. I like that. Phil offering his honesty here is where he does start to make that transition from selfishness to selflessness. And I think that is the journey that Ramis frames the film around, higher and above the romantic journey that it also includes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my number one is one of the only scenes in Groundhog Day I like better than the scene you just described.
Okay, what is
which
it?
Which is, it's in this day, again, straight back to Second City. There's a improv game called Rewind, and it's a classic standard kind of building block of all improv training and sketch comedy writing, where you just, you know, have characters, you know, this is in rehearsal and sometimes in performance, where you do a scene and then you hit, somebody yells out or hits a bell, ding, or says rewind, and you take the scene back, back to the beginning, and then you take it in a different direction. Take it in a different direction. Do it again. This is Groundhog Day in a nutshell, right? It is the improv game Rewind in a nutshell. And the best example of that in the film, I think, is where he's trying to, and in a way where, you know, his motives may or may not be particularly low or high. We don't really know. He might just be coming on to Rita at this point, where he's saying, you know, he's just trying to get to know her over and over, unbeknownst to her, in over a drink in the bar. And he says, So what brought you here? And she says, well, believe it or not, in college I studied 19th century French poetry. And his immediate reaction is, what a waste of time. You know? And then he's like, he realizes he's not going to get her that way. And he says, well, I mean, for somebody else, that would be an incredible waste of time. And then without any fuss, bing, you sort of, the invisible ding goes off on the soundtrack, or the inaudible ding, and then you're back to the beginning of the scene again. And, you know, they take it again.
I think people place too much emphasis on their careers. Gosh, I wish we could all live in the mountains. At high altitudes. That's where I see myself in 5 years. How about you?
Oh, I agree. I just like to go with the flow.
Yeah?
See what happens.
Well, it's gotten you here.
Uh-huh. Of course, it's a million miles from where I started out in college.
Oh, yeah? You weren't in broadcasting or journalism, anything like that?
Believe it or not, I studied 19th century French poetry.
La fille qui j'aimerais sera comme bon vin. C'est bon fière, un peu, chaque matin.
You speak French.
To me, that is the funniest bit. It's the funniest thing in the film. It's still as funny as it was when I first saw it. And it takes you, it is the, it's Harold Ramis and Bill Murray saying, this is what we learned at Second City, and look how valuable it is. You can take any comic situation and build on it. And it's my favorite scene in Groundhog.
Translating it to the film medium, right? Because yes. The editing is so crucial to how those work as well. It's perfectly timed. Good pick. My number one, I'm probably going to be accused of going the sentimental route here, but it is that lunch conversation he has with Seth Rogen that we heard from Knocked Up. And Judd Apatow, Knocked Up's writer-director, he cited Ramis as a key comedic influence on him. He gave Ramis this cameo as the father of Seth Rogen's character, who at this point has found out that the woman he had a one-night stand with, Katherine Heigl, is pregnant. I think it's important to note that before this scene, there is a similar one with Heigl's character and her mother, who's played by Joanna Kearns. And her mother sort of callously tells her that she should have an abortion so that later in life she could have a real baby, is how she terms it. And we suddenly cut to Ramis's father, who has a very different reaction. It's this contemplative, unruffled vibe that, you know, there has to be something of an echo here to that Zen Buddhism that he did embrace in the late 1980s to this scene. I think it also shows his growth, or at least his relaxed nature as an actor a little bit, even though he'd pretty much given that up except for some of the cameos we've talked about here and there. He's playing this scene as a completely authentic, emotional moment, and he's allowing the jokes to come out of the conversation. It's almost the opposite of what he talked about, how he did his earlier career, where he'd lob in one-liners, which was very effective and very funny. But it's just an interesting contrast here to see how he sits back and lets them bubble up from his conversation with Rogen.
I'm going to be a grandfather.
You happy about that?
Absolutely. Delighted.
This is a disaster.
No, this is not a disaster.
It is.
An earthquake is a disaster. Your grandmother having Alzheimer's so bad she doesn't even know who the f*** I am. That's a disaster. This is a good thing. This is a blessing.
It's maybe not one of his funniest moments, though he does get in quite a few good lines, as you'd expect. But for me, it's just a wonderful way to remember him.
Yeah, it's exactly. And this is Judd Apatow just saying, and all these guys who just, they're just saying thank you for the good work. And now you can just sort of enjoy this little turn as a character actor. And he does it beautifully, very, very realistically. He's not pushing for the comedy. He's letting Seth Rogen take care of that. I mean, he's the star. And Ramis just has a great antenna and a great radar for how much to give when. And, oh, no, that scene's great. I mean, it's those scenes that make Knocked Up feel like it's got human beings in a predicament, not just jokes in a row.
Those are our top five Harold Ramis moments. Please do email us your picks, whether you were a young kid who was inappropriately watching his films at a neighbor's house or a 17-year-old college-bound enjoying Animal House. We want to hear your memories about Ramis's career. You can email us at feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting. In limited release in Chicago this weekend is Bethlehem. This is an Israeli thriller about a Secret Service officer and his Palestinian informant. We also have Elaine Stritch, Shoot Me opening, and this is what little confidence Sam Van Halgren, our producer, has in my ability to pronounce things. He wrote it out here, Stritch rhymes with itch, just to let me know that, so I wouldn't mess that one up.
Right.
So it is
because
Elaine
that spelling
Stritch.
Is so tricky.
It's Stritch. A little tricky.
It's
it is. This is, of course, a documentary about the Tony and Emmy Award winner. Also opening, In Fear, which is set in rural Ireland, a British psychological thriller that played at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival. And The Lunchbox, a romance from India starring Irfan Khan. And one more here, Visitors, a documentary from Godfrey Reggio, who's the director of the Qatsi trilogy. Sam, thank you for spelling that one out for me. In wide release, 300 Rise of an Empire. Michael, you are fresh off a screening of that film. Can you give us a micro review of it?
Well, the dialogue, Josh, I liked the best was where the guy went, you know,
really?
and then there's a slow motion arrow in the eye, and then a quick shot, and then it slows down suddenly, and then the blood is there's a lot of splurch.
So
the word splurch, there's just a splurching and the bleeding and the. With the digital and...
Sounds like they took this in a really different direction.
They did.
This franchise
is going... It's more like a Terrence Rattigan thing.
Okay, sounds good. Opening wide also is The Bagman. By all accounts, this is not the John Cusack, Robert De Niro pairing you were hoping for. And Mr. Peabody and Sherman, The Adventures of a Boy and His Genius Dog. It's an animated film that's based on characters from the Peabody's Improbable History segments on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. Next week, Michael, You'll be back here joining me for our review of The Grand Budapest Hotel. We're also going to do our top five Wes Anderson scenes.
Josh, I'm not going to leave the studio until we tape that next show. I'm so excited.
I like your dedication, although you might have to go see Grand Budapest Hotel first.
We'll let
you out for that.
If I was going to be intellectually honest, yes, I would try to see it before talking about it. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music this week, Stephen Malkmus and the Jicks from the new album Wig Out at Jag Bags. More information at StephenMalkmus.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.